Time for hour number two of Dr. and Mrs. Future.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, I'm Mrs. Future here. You want to exchange the doctorate? You want to like to be a doctor for a while, Mrs. Future? Well, I don't know if I want to be Mrs., though.
I think I you are doctoring the future. How's
doctoring
that?
Doctoring the future. Yeah. Okay. Well,
I
with
like
that,
being Mrs. Future.
You do? Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's keep it the way it is, then.
Right. Married to the future.
Yes. The future is now. So welcome back to the show, folks. You've heard a lot lately about asteroids. They've been in the news quite a bit lately about how we're almost getting whacked by one, or we're going to mine them and become trillionaires, or we should protect them and stop them from being abused, and you name it. They're big in the news. And we're going to look at them a little more closely in this next couple of segments with Dr. Bruce Damer, who has been doing active research in the asteroid world. Bruce is an American-Canadian independent scientist, a designer, author, and he collaborates with colleagues around the world for looking at spacecraft designs, spacecraft architectures that would be able to collect asteroids in this case, and also the origin of life, which we'll talk about a little bit later. So, Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Future.
All right. So, what do you think, Bruce? Do you think the first trillionaires will be asteroid miners?
I think the first trillionaire will probably be Jeff Bezos at
the yeah, Blue Origin.
Going already, just by mining the internet.
Just starting with the internet revolution is the form of wealth. But they're saying, though, that there's a tremendous amount of wealth in the asteroids out there, and that it's just a matter of getting them.
Yeah, we're actively developing a technology which you and Mrs. Future saw in my TEDx talk in Santa Cruz in 2015.
Yes.
Which is to throw a fabric enclosure and encapsulate a fabric enclosure around an asteroid, the whole asteroid, and then extract things from it by using an atmosphere to control it and extract water and things for fuel first off and minerals later.
So it'll be easier to do that than to try to mine on Earth where you go deep into the ground? It seems like a lot of digging won't be necessary.
Right. So for asteroid mining, you actually can't throw cables around them. You can't grind material up or sort of dig it out of the surface because you're very low gravity. And so the stuff just flies everywhere and becomes a hazard. Mm. So it's very difficult to manage material. So instead, we introduce inside a membrane an atmosphere to then detumble and steer and drive asteroids around using gas pressure, kind of like blowing on it.
Right. It's like putting it in a big round baggie.
Exactly. When you put an atmosphere around something, you can manipulate it chemically. Mm. Change the temperature. Not just its motion, but if it has water ice in it, you can basically melt and sublimate that off and then collect mm-hmm. it in your tanks and make fuel and make consumables for spacecraft, like, say, Elon or Jeff Bezos wanting to go to Mars or Moon. You can actually deliver the fuel to where they need it.
Hmm. So do you envision different types of enclosures that would be designed for different forms of extracting resources from the asteroid, like some for water, others for metal?
Yeah, in fact, it was now almost 5 years ago, we developed the Shepard concept, and that's our acronym for this technology. A space lawyer from Houston said, "Don't y'all know about the Mond process?" And I said, "What's that?" He said, "You can use gas, carbon dioxide gas, to pull nickel and other metals out of a block and 3D print it inside of an enclosure." So it turns out we probably, through gas extraction, have a way to make big parts in space and make those space habitats that Jeff Bezos was talking about this week.
Okay, so you're talking about being able to create the actual habitats from materials found in space rather than importing them from the planet.
Yeah, if you look at the Stanley Kubrick's big space station in 2001, all those trusses and beams and whatnot would not be able to be lifted from Earth. It would just be too costly. But if you can fab them in space, like a Maker Faire kind of a thing with a 3D printer, you can build all those big colonies.
Huh. Do you think that Bezos' plans for the moon make sense?
They possibly don't, because if you're going to go mining on the moon, you need to have a... If you look at mining operations on Earth, they're really complex, and equipment breaks constantly, and you need constant people there to maintain them. So you need steps. I mean, you blast the rock, and you put it on a conveyor, and you put it into a smelter, and you process it, and you, in his case, extracting some ice for water, and then you got to put it in a container, and then you got to deliver the container up into space when you've got these ice-filled rocks flying by Earth all the time. And so this really makes no sense to do all that work on the lunar surface for very little water when you've got mega tonnage of it floating around the solar
system. Just out there, we could just catch them. Like fishing, yeah. Almost like fishing in a way, huh?
Almost like fishing, and just by putting them in the gas-filled enclosure, you do all those steps in one place. So we're going to, at some point, head up to Blue Origin and talk to them. We were in Luxembourg talking to the government there and just starting getting ready to make this into a real thing.
By the way, you know, the first article that we had this week mentions Luxembourg as playing a role in the first attempts at creating companies. Yes, they're interested in the Japanese project, which you actually went to Japan to check out, right?
Yeah, it's been quite a 6 months, guys. I've been in Japan at a major Hayabusa 2 meeting where we literally saw live footage from there. We were hosted in Japan. And then I went to Luxembourg to talk to their space agency, which is a tiny country with a big space agency. And they're really interested in lunar and asteroid mining, and talked to them about the alternative to trying to this very difficult extraction of water ice from the moon versus this other solution, which is also difficult. I'm not saying ours is easy. It's a big unknown.
Right. So it's, I guess, a matter of actually getting some experiments, testing these techniques out and making them happen at this point.
We went to a CubeSat workshop where we learned how to make tiny satellites to try this out for real in space with the smallest little thing.
Bruce, can you hold on? We've got to go to a break for a moment.
Yep.
Yeah, we'll be right back. Talking to Bruce Damer on asteroids and asteroid mining related topics. Welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer, currently on asteroids and asteroid capture, asteroid analysis, asteroid mining, and related topics. A couple questions come in from the audience, Bruce. One is, can your Shepard tech save us from a killer asteroid?
That's a really good question from an audience member. In fact, it's one of the candidate technologies to do that. Huh. Say, for instance, after 50 years or something of development, we learn how to encapsulate a really big asteroid, like a half mile or a mile wide.
Huh.
And we can gradually, big baggy, we can gradually shift its orbit. So as long as we do this early enough, we can gradually change its orbit. The other solutions are gravity tractoring or just hitting it with a projectile. But if you hit it with a projectile, you end up like instead of taking a rifle bullet, you end up with a shotgun.
It's like that cascade effect that was in the movie Gravity, where you have lots of particles that could cause more problems.
You want to gently handle these things, and you can do it through this gas pressure technique.
Huh.
Bruce, what are the consequences if the asteroids are not handled gently?
They tend to come apart. A lot of them are consolidated rubble piles, and there's big boulders sitting on the surface. And that's why you can't sort of sit there and, like Bruce Willis, and use a jackhammer. I mean, there's no gravity for one, and stuff just flying everywhere. Because, they just accumulate boulders and pieces, and they came together as pieces, so they're very frail in a sense.
Yes. What about the detection? Apparently, one of the problems with detection is that they're so dark that you don't see them coming.
And for this sort of sky surveys and things like that, we can detect things optically, but in order to actually mine something, you need to go out with a mission to find out where it is and how it's heading.
Yes, you have scout ships, in a sense, that are looking for them.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like the minerals business, where you have to go and find a source of gold somewhere, and then you finance a development effort on it, sell your claim, on hopefully someone doesn't jump your claim.
Well, there's going to be that, isn't there? One of the articles this week was about that. There's an interest to create the equivalent of a national park system for the solar system, that we shouldn't touch a lot of the planet and that to protect it. But how are we going to do that? Who's going to pay for a police force that's going to watch the asteroid belt? It's kind of like the Wild West, isn't it?
It's an impractical and nonsensical idea because
it's
a vast place, and what do you decide to protect and what are the criteria for protecting? And humans aren't going to touch more than a tiny fraction of what's out there in 1,000 years, even if we had an active program.
1,000 years, really?
I mean,
it's like trying to protect every grain of sand on every beach.
Yeah, it's kind of a nonsensical idea, and it's sort of annoying.
Well, and yet there must be some places that are worthy candidates for protection.
There would be, but of course, on Earth, we're trying to protect life. And there, as far as we know, there's no life yet detected anywhere in the solar system. So you're talking about dead, hot, and cold rock. You know, so what are we?
And most of what are we protecting it from exactly?
Ourselves. What are we protecting it from? It's been subject to collisions. It's radiated. What exactly are you protecting out there?
So you think we should save our protection energy for focusing a little closer to home?
Exactly. Yeah, very good point, Mrs. Future.
So you think we should just send a bunch of ambitious missions up to let people do whatever they want out there?
I think we have to know our species. We need to establish infrastructure in the solar system to take pressure off the Earth and then to also learn how to manage the Earth better. So if we have to run biospheres out there and support large megastructures, we're going to really learn what it takes to manage a biosphere if we're going to replicate them.
A lot of people have called in the past saying, why do we put our attention on space when we have so many problems here? Isn't it better to focus our resources on this planet because it's hard to get into space? What big lessons can we really learn from going to space that might be applied here, I guess would be a better question.
We've learned everything. I mean, if we hadn't gone to space, we wouldn't really understand that we have a super integrative biosphere. We wouldn't have an overview on our planet and our future.
That's right, the overview. Yeah.
The overview, and we wouldn't have global communications like we have. We wouldn't understand how rare we are in the universe. So it has a philosophical, almost spiritual value.
Mm. And how we're just a pale blue dot in an infinite.
Yeah, and we're rare. I mean, complex life is extraordinarily rare, most likely, yeah.
Do you have any stories that connect our space travel experiments with our ocean travel experiments?
In a sense, when we try to do undersea operations, we find out how difficult it is to keep people alive in these deep undersea environments with easy resupply. Space is super challenging for living systems. I think we're a long way from sending people to Mars, just a long way.
Yeah, you don't think it'll be 2030s like NASA has been predicting?
It's hard to imagine because the amount of problems that need to be solved, like the refueling problem, which you need to supply from space, and then the radiation shielding problem, the food supplies, the redundant components, you know, making safe landings, getting crews back. I mean, that's
gravity on bone.
I know, but we're a bright species. We've got supercomputers. We've got a lot.
But we don't have anyone making sufficient investments yet.
We need more money on this, more focused attention.
You need a commitment. And they're really, the individual private company, I doubt, can do this. They can pull this off. They can generate a launch system, but we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars of capital and hundreds of thousands of people to do a manned Mars mission or a human to Mars mission.
Mm. Well, and then, of course, the issue always comes up of, are we focusing our resources to benefit just a very few people and ignoring how to focus those resources on the population at large here on the planet?
Yeah, and in the 2050s, sea level is rising, or we have a pandemic, or we have any number of things, big changes in agriculture. We've got to do trillions of dollars of mitigation investment, climate mitigation investment has to start for those possibilities.
Hmm.
Ah, that's where all the new jobs can come from in this new economy, right? Climate mitigation.
Yeah, climate mitigation is the new thing. You know, we know it's coming and we can invest.
Hmm. Greg Panos has a question for you from our little earlier conversation. He wants to know how the fine-grained nature of moon dust causes its own maintenance nightmares for equipment in that environment.
Yeah, in the 70s, Jerry O'Neill argued that the lunar or planetary surfaces were terrible places to try to expand human civilization, and dust on the moon is one example. It's called agglutinates, and it tends to cut through material and break seals, and it's really, really difficult, the Apollo crews discovered.
So another good reason to stay with the asteroids and not go to the surface of a planet.
Yeah, you need a clean place with energy and doesn't swing in temperature, and you can control your environment. That's why living on a space station, that's why we live on space stations. We need to control everything that's going on.
It's a good place to practice for larger missions.
Being on the moon means you have to ship stuff up and down a gravity well. So the moon doesn't really get you much. It gets you a place to sit, but then you have all these costs of getting up and down.
But as far as you can see, there's no real value to the materials there compared to what we can find more easily in the asteroid belt or in the asteroid Earth objects.
Every August during meteor showers, you're seeing all this wonderful stuff coming. Those meteor showers are volatiles. Their materials are coming into the atmosphere from a comet tail. I mean, they're being delivered to the Earth in megatonnage all the time. So, it really doesn't make sense to go to a dry, irradiated, hazardous, dusty place to try to do operations.
So I was reading that all of the precious metals on Earth, the gold, the titanium, etc., are all deposited here by asteroids anyway, that anything that was basically other than iron was destroyed when the Earth formed. And so everything that we can find was deposited here later.
Yeah, I think it's, is it Inco in Quebec? Big asteroid impact zone where there's huge nickel mines in Quebec, and it was all just, that's where the source was. And there's just enormous amounts of metals and carbonaceous materials and, of course, water, CO2, methane. It's just, in fact, life may have started on Earth with the depositing of these rich organics that came in from the dusty early solar system.
And the solar system formation. I just get an idea about the asteroids. Could they form an atmosphere or help form the atmosphere for the planet?
Yeah, Dr. Future, that's a huge insight you had. Once you start heating up an asteroid with an introduced gas that has some of this water ice, it's going to start just evaporating off and provide its own atmosphere and its own fuel to move it. So once it's extracted and separated into hydrogen and oxygen, you can actually use all that energy to start shifting the whole system and, say, move it to orbit around the moon for continuous extraction. This is very versatile, what we can do with this.
Do you think asteroids played a role in creating our environment on this? I guess they brought the water in. That would be the comets, right?
At UC Santa Cruz, we have a meteorite collection, and it contains rich organics, fatty acids, amino acids, nucleobases, and these are asteroids as old as the Earth. And so if we grind them up into a powder and put them into sort of an acid solution, they form these little things called protocells that are perhaps how life got started. So these asteroids, we're made out of them. As Carl Sagan said, we're all star stuff.
If you can stay for one more segment, we'd like to talk about your other work in The Origin of Life and how perhaps these asteroids led to life itself or how they might play a role in the creation of biological life. One of the big questions is it what's happening on this planet unique? Is this, so far, what you can see as a scientist, this is it, right? But all the ingredients seem to be coming from out there.
We don't have much evidence. We have a lot of evidence of other solar systems, but there's ways that planets can die, numerous ways that, how many ways to leave your lover, probably more ways to have a planet die and go out of what's called the habitable zone.
Right. In fact, that motivates a lot of
Venus and Mars. Yeah.
A lot of the space research is about finding alternatives to planet Earth just in case, right?
Well, I'm going to a conference up in Bellevue, Washington next month called Astrobiology Science, and it's just packed with people thinking about this. It's
awesome. Really, well, let's continue thinking a little bit more about that after the break.
And we have callers.
We have callers. All right. All right, Bruce.
Oh, great.
You're on. We'll be back in a few minutes talking to Dr. Bruce Damer on asteroids and origin of life.
Okay, Dr. Future Show, here's our break.
Hey there, welcome back to the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show and Dr. Bruce Damer on the line about the origins of life and asteroids. And we do have a question from the audience we'd feel first before we delve too deeply into this.
Yeah. Hello, Andre in Capitola. Welcome to the show.
Am I on? Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on.
Yes,
we hear you.
Can.
Yes, you're on with Dr. Damer.
Hey, question. Doctor, you were saying that it doesn't make any sense for Bezos to be saying that it's time to mine the asteroids. He's a smart guy, I assume. He's a smart guy. Do you think that's a cover story, or you think he doesn't know any better? Could he be saying this to get out there and put that on as a story while he's actually doing something else, maybe with communications or just, I don't know what else it could be. I know that there's some treaties out there, international treaties that say the first person to lay claim on any body, as long as you plant the flag, it belongs to you.
I see. He's going to give cause for the need for a space force?
He might be the next...
He's going to be the first outlaw
these
billionaire.
These are all great questions. There's a general sort of moon rush going right now because there was the Google Lunar X Prize, and there's just this interest in going back to the moon after so long because, let's face it, it's the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 coming up right now.
Right.
So there's interest, and the moon's an easy place to actually get to. It's a three-day trip, really, and many nations now have landed on it, yet to have a private lander succeed. And the moon sort of seems familiar. You know, it's got hills and valleys, and it's got geology and whatnot. So people have walked on it. So it's a familiar thing. Whereas
you can see the Earth from there.
You can see the Earth from there. Whereas asteroids are these kind of a little bit more alien. Think of asteroids like trying to hunt the great white whale. You know, you don't quite know where it is, but you know where the harbor is and the island.
Yeah, it's more of a sea adventure than a land adventure.
Yeah, and so you have to probe deep. And asteroids are new. I mean, we're just literally the American mission and the Japanese mission are orbiting their targets, and it's a brand new thing. And so we're just learning about them. We've known about the moon for over 50 years. So in a way, it's sort of a safe place. But also, I think there's a misconception about how easy or hard it is to operate on the moon. And when you see these lunar colonies and whatnot, I would challenge every one of them, and others have. I mean, lunar scientists have challenged a lot of these things that they're really impractical to operate to bury the pressurized habitat. It's very costly to get all that material to the moon, and there's no resources. So it looks like a place people can be, but when you look at Apollo, they had to leave after 3 days because the lunar surface is getting hot during the lunar day, and they wouldn't really have survived a lunar day-night cycle. So talking a three-day mission. So people have to be realistic about what they're trying to do. And I think a lot of people just sort of rush into the idea.
Well, maybe he thinks of it as an Amazon Prime movie set. You know, I mean, he does own one of the biggest movie studios in the world now. And well, why not the solar system as your playground?
Yeah, and in a sense, film. The lunar landing on the moon was very dramatic. It was one of the great moments in TV history.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone watched that show. If he did a reality show from the surface of the moon, that would be a big hit. Probably pay for itself.
Well, and in terms of other motives, people who embrace far-off dreams are not necessarily sure that those dreams are going to happen, but they sure are going to have fun while they get closer.
When it comes down to it, we have to actually be realistic of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And we're going to a space mining conference in about 3 weeks here in Colorado to meet with everyone who seriously looks at operating on the moon or mining asteroids. And it's going to be really fascinating it's like 50, 60 people who actually work on this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and I think that some of these investments are going towards robotics, and they're going towards package delivery, and they're going towards things that Bezos can definitely put into his business here on Earth, right?
Yeah.
Andrea and Capitola, thanks for your question.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time.
Sure.
All right.
So, Bruce, we were talking about how asteroids might have led to the beginning of biological life as we know it. Some of the ingredients are in them for life, such as amino acids, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's quite remarkable that these complex organic compounds are made in abundance in space through just what is called cosmochemistry. And you can look out at these dusty solar system disks of newly forming planets, and they're full of these organics. So it's now thought that in the field that this is the likely source of the building blocks of life. Hmm.
And so they've been bombarding planets time immemorial and probably many solar systems in the universe.
Yeah. they can only get concentrated enough. If they fall in the oceans, that they get lost through dilution. But if they fall in little pools on land that are warm, they can form chemical reactions and form polymers. And that's what Charles Darwin thought back in 1871 when he talked about life beginning in a warm little pond somewhere.
And those would happen in what our scientists are calling the Goldilocks zone?
Yeah, and it's also like a Goldilocks pool. So your planet's sweeping up its organic things and its Bragg's amino acids, and they fall onto a volcanic landscape with bubbling pools that are filling and refilling with warm waters, and there's all kinds of chemistry happening just like you see at Yellowstone. By gosh, and we've been going out to Yellowstone and New Zealand and everywhere and getting this chemistry to work in these pools.
And has it been?
It's been working. In fact, last week, a new scientist ran a major story about our trip to New Zealand where we got long, long polymers of RNA to form in these pool conditions.
For the uninitiated, how do you describe the overall gist of this experiment? The raw ingredients for creating life, the right combinations that would create the soup that generated us, something like that?
Yeah, and the key thing is cycling. So the key thing is that the pools dry down every once in a while.
Yeah, they evaporate.
Yeah. They evaporate, and so you get this high concentration of this stuff on the surface, like a bathtub ring.
Right.
And then when you refill the pool, it forms little things called protocells out of all that stuff. And then
it reactivates the stuff to create protocells.
And then the stuff are like rolling coins or rolling dice. And so it's like a huge roulette wheel of which protocell is going to be more stable. And then they survive the next dry down, and then you create a trillion more of them, and then gradually they start having functions.
So it's constantly saturating the past, the rings, with the present, with the liquids of the now.
Yeah, and it works. It works in the lab, and it's now starting to work out in the field. So, science now has a testable hypothesis it's never had before.
Mm-hmm. And it'll only take a few billion years to see if it turns into new humans.
Yeah, it would. But, it's interesting, and we're never going to create life in the lab this way, but we're going to do things that are suggestive that this is how life can start.
Do you think we'll be able to generate life in the lab?
Probably not. I think it's just beyond the scope of science. You can probably hack existing cells, but that's hardly creating life in the lab.
Yeah, there's some teams that are deeply into that, on how we can infinitely modify biology. Like, for example, if we did move to the moon or orbit, wouldn't we want to design bodies that are more appropriate for those environments that we'll be spending time in?
Well, it turns out if you don't have legs, you're actually better in space.
There you go. So you have a ball body.
Earth favors round orbiting rocks, right?
I mean, look what we've done with dogs over the years. Surely we can do even better with humans.
I think we're doing that with humans through media saturation and diet. I think
really?
We're definitely morphing. It's like WALL-E. We're becoming everyone in the WALL-E.
Yeah, we're getting more round anyway.
Doing it anyway, by our own choice, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we are breeding ourselves for space, for some of us. Yeah.
And we're all going to be drinking milkshakes every day for every meal.
But what's in those milkshakes?
Yeah, I'm pretty fond of my daily shake, actually.
Yeah, it's some kind of primordial goo. It seems alive.
It's an amazing time in science now and in space. And I'm all for all space ventures. I think we really need to do it. And getting private companies involved is such a good thing because government just takes forever. And the innovation is fantastic. SpaceX landing their boosters and just doing such a phenomenal job. And I met with somebody from Blue Origin recently, and their new Glenn rocket is just going to be so impressive. I mean, my goodness, who would have thought that PayPal and Amazon would generate a revolution in launch to orbit? But they have,
It is amazing, yes. And I wonder, do you think there's a chance these companies could collaborate better in a way that would speed the process up a little? Or are they doing it just right, in your opinion?
They're doing it just right. I think to have two or three major competitors is what you want. And Jeff's approach is different than Elon's approach. And we need to have an ecosystem of approaches and innovations.
So for the uninitiated, could you basically describe the difference between the two approaches?
Well, both of them have recreated old-fashioned rockets. I mean, there really isn't a whole lot of evolution in rocket technology since the 60s, but Jeff is doing this sort of, they're fatter rockets, and they, of course, land, and the capsules are bigger and they're wider, and he can do different things with Blue Origin vehicles. Elon, of course, has the legs on it, lands the first stage, and there you have a common core, and they have common engines on all the stages, and there's a lot of fantastic computer technology in it too. We know less about Jeff Bezos's efforts.
Well, it looks like he's trying to fly people into space. I can see the design. He thinks there's a big market in going up to the Kármán line and back.
Yeah, he looks like he's in the deliveries market, delivering people.
And in fact, if you look at what they're doing compared to Virgin Galactic, where you basically have an aircraft that becomes a rocket and then goes across the parabola and people look, well, Blue Origin is actually shooting straight up and the capsule is getting very high and it's very big and then it's coming back down.
Right, they're doing a little microgravity tourist trip.
Yeah, and of course, they'll go beyond that. I think New Glenn will be able to deliver enormous payloads.
Yes, and that's where the moon lander comes in, the Blue Moon, as he's calling it.
Yeah, it's just being smarter about manufacturing the whole supply chain, about building stuff cheaper and more reliably. And the irony is that the old Soviet Union did such a better job than most Western governments at building proton boosters. They actually nailed that, a long time ago, with their systems so reliable and so low cost.
Can you hold on for a sec, Bruce? We're just going to a break.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks. Be right back. I'm talking to Dr. Bruce Damer. Hey, Bruce. Welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer with Business Future on asteroids, asteroid mining, origin of life. And we have a question from the audience about the future of the economic system. They say trillions of dollars will be coming in from this. I'm sure Bezos, the world's richest man, is interested in money. What's the future model for this if it's worth so much? Is that true?
It's not really true. I mean, it's so far away. We're talking mid to late century.
Yeah, so big money is 100 years out at least.
Yeah, big money is right now people clicking on social media links.
big money is technology of the internet.
Yeah, we haven't even got to step one. It was almost like if Europeans thought that there must be other continents out there and that big money could be made. And so they invented the first wooden boat and they managed to get it to float off their coast. That's kind of where we are, you know.
Another question regarding space exploration. The question is, are you familiar with the concept of a DNA arc?
DNA arc, you mean like preserving, kind of like the Svalbard seed bank up in Norway?
Yeah, I guess so. I assume that's asking.
Definitely, that's an existing one. That's a plant seed bank.
Yes. If we wanted to send our life form, our biological life, to somewhere else, that's one of the trajectories for doing so, it seems, in my mind.
The problem is you need a whole ecosystem and to turn that DNA into living forms. You can't just send DNA in a capsule and expect anything. It'll actually just get broken down over time.
Oh, I see. So you have to send a whole, like a spaceship that has a whole living ecosystem in it.
And one of the variations on our Shepard design is that instead of melting all the water off the asteroid, we melt it into a globule with rock in the middle, and then we introduce life into the globule and light it up from inside. Then you could have basically a terrarium in space and have a harvestable medium.
That sounds really cool. What would you harvest? Algae?
Well, you start with algaes and shrimps for the Barbie. And they've done all these experiments with these types of things in space already. And it's like those glass globes you buy that are sealed. And all you have to do is light them up and there's shrimp in there and they live for 100 years.
Cool.
Ed in Felton wants to know if you've heard of the TV series The Expanse.
You know, I have, and it was one of the shows I wanted to come up to Future Peak to watch.
Ah, okay. We have that capacity. She should do that. Maybe even watch it from the hot tub.
Exactly, because I don't get a whole lot of TV down here, so I always rely on Dr. and Mrs. Future to recommend what to watch.
You see, Dr. Damer lives in the same town we do, Boulder Creek, California, a nice little mountain town up here that has a lot of interesting folks living there. We live in a very special community, I think.
It really is. It's so sweet.
Yeah. Scott, Bruce, it's really great having you on the show. I really appreciate your insights onto these things. It's an unfolding movie. What's exciting you next about this whole thing? What's coming up for you in the space world?
It's just sort of seeing that all these new players are in the game, and as they try things out, what works and what doesn't. I mean, we're floating our idea, and somebody may take that up and invest in it and run with it. Mm. It's wonderful because things are really stalled out. You know, the shuttle stopped flying, and we just had one space station, and things were sort of stalled out in human space flight, but now they're sort of opening.
Yeah, I mean, I felt as a kid that we'd be way further along than this. I mean, I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey as a teenager. So what happened, you know? Can we catch up?
I saw it, and I thought, that station has to be built from stuff in space. And that was when I was 13, and I started working on it in the 70s. Yeah, you designing saw how, asteroid miners, yeah.
Yeah, you saw how ridiculous it was to carry all that material into space to build the space station.
Yeah, just I looked at the little Pan Am shuttle, and I thought that the cargo version of that wouldn't hold the beams that Kubrick was showing in the unconstructed part of his rotating station. So I said, well, it's launched by big boosters, and it's too costly. That's not how to build a space station.
Question from Eric in Petaluma. He's very curious about the super secret space program, if there's anything to that that George Norrie talks about on Coast to Coast.
It's made up nonsense in people's imaginations. It's one of those other things I call annoying, simply annoying. Because, you know, they've got to come up with evidence. And frankly, most programs, you know, pretty much all programs, are very much in the public. You know, I looked up keyhole satellites, which were, you know, it's a classified surveillance thing, and there's huge Wikipedia articles about it. There's no way to make a super secret thing on, especially space programs where launches are big and loud and noisy.
Well, they're supposed to be from Antarctica, from my understanding.
That's ridiculous.
It's a secret base in Antarctica. Yeah, that's all made up, huh?
It's all made up, and it's just annoying because it distracts people from sort of productive work on getting things done. It's entertainment. It's sort of like sci-fi in a way.
So the level of the flat Earth?
Yeah, it's the danger we have is that young people get sucked into this and they're in these rabbit holes, wormholes for years and they, you know, believing this stuff. And I've met many that have sort of come out of these made up belief systems and then they start to do some real science and engineering and get into the real projects, but they've wasted all that time.
What's your criteria for discovering true facts versus nonsense made up stuff?
Yeah, and you deal with fake news.
It's got to be in, you can tell even by the language. Oh. There's like sort of a guidebook to conspiracy theory, and it's, I'm not an expert in this, but you can tell by the language that is used.
Because something is too secret to know what the facts really are. And yet, here's a clue that is beyond deniability.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and you say, is it in peer reviewed literature? Is it in engineering? Can I visit a place where things are happening?
Well, that's the academic world. I mean, the argument is that these things are a black budget.
Yeah, but the black budget uses the same contractors and the same people. They have the same conferences. They use the same networks.
There's no way it could be that much of a secret, in other words.
No. The Soviet Union itself, which was a super secret society and closed, was unable to, it was pretty much an open book on what was going on there. You just looked from space and you send people on down on the street. There's no way to hide big things.
So let's say if we had discovered anti-gravity and it went black, we wouldn't be able to keep that secret?
No, I mean, there'd be teams all over the world discovering it at the same time because they'd be at the edge of...
Like the invention of the light bulb or the television or whatever. It's just in the ethers for that to be invented.
Yeah, it's in the ether. You tend to see inventions happening simultaneously in two or three places, and then other countries take it up and develop it and just moves around. It's a very open system now.
Yes, so it would appear simultaneously in both the closed source and the open source world.
Yeah, and it's mostly an open source world. It's pretty much all open source at this point.
Well, certainly
everyone's got a smartphone.
And nature is certainly open source. Whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and what's the motivation for spending huge resources to do secret programs that when you need, you're totally dependent. I mean, you need to get gas at the gas station before you drive in your secret base so people see you driving on your seat. We ought to question those people strongly and say, you know, question those making the claims. Okay, come back tomorrow with more substantial evidence. Just be skeptical.
Yeah, what would you consider real evidence?
Just, hey, if you think a UFO crashed, bring something that is clearly not of human technology and bring it in an artifact case and let's take a look at it under our scanning tunneling microscope, and by gosh, it's not made in a foundry on Earth, and it's like really cool. Like it'll bring something.
Real alien circuit board would be good.
Yeah, right? Like bring alien Pong. You know what?
Alien Pong.
Alien Pong. You know, what would they? Multi-armed multiplayer Pong from. Something, but bring anything, not just stories. And this ends up being just stories, and it's no better than religion.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that reminds me. You were sending around a really fun comic about religion that was very insightful, I thought.
Yeah, it was a cartoon. I reshared a cartoon. I wish I'd be able to draw that. That said it all right there.
Said it
you
all.
You could do a similar one for conspiracy theories. I think that's just kind of a kind of religion in a way.
No, you have a very strong opinion on these conspiracies. And they take up so much of the public time.
It's such a waste. It's a danger to our civilization because it's just sopping up all this brain power and creating anxiety because these stories tend to try to separate one group from another and set them against each other. It's really terrible.
Mm. And it just takes up our valuable resources of time and energy that could be used for solving some of the real problems in the world.
So what belief system would you put your religious faith into?
Well, just like the Dalai Lama, when he was asked recently, would you place the future of humanity on spiritual quests and inquiry or on science? And he turned and said, without hesitation, he said, science.
Because science is peer-reviewed.
Yeah,
we've got a lot of people asking questions and agreeing on what are the best answers or at least the best approaches.
It's a tough hazing exercise, and it has to be to maintain its quality. Science and engineering have to deliver, and medicine, they have to deliver in the end.
Is there a spirituality to science and engineering?
It's actually starting to merge now.
Is it?
You know, there's a merger of things going on. It's very interesting.
It's where the science shamanism intersections lie, perhaps.
All kinds of things.
All kinds of things, exactly. Well, to be continued then in this story. But thank you, Bruce, for being on the show today. Dr. Bruce Damer on Origins of Life, Science, the Universe, and everything in it.
And everything.
And Mrs. Future. So have a good week, folks, and have a great week yourself, Bruce. We'll see you in the hot tub soon.
We'll see you at the tub. All thank right. you, Mrs. Future, too.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody. Another week of the future in the archive.